Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
As all of you will know who have ever picked up a copy of Dante's Divine Comedy, the poem begins with a profound encounter. Dante, in the middle of the journey of our life, attempts to climb the mountain of virtue, of holiness, but he fails. He falls into a ditch, a dead end. And at that very moment, a miraculous but surprising grace is given him. He's met by the classical poet Virgil, poet of the Aeneid. Here Dante embodies in fiction an experience at once humdrum, very ordinary, and marvellous, extraordinary, that all of you, all of us, readers of literature, I think, can relate to. That is the encounter with the soul, with the essence of an author through that author's works, through their writings. Dante writes, "Before my eyes was offered to me one who, through long silence, appeared hoarse. But how can someone who has yet to speak appear hoarse?" How does Dante know that Virgil appears hoarse through long silence, when Virgil has only just appeared to him and said not a word? It's surely because Dante is referring symbolically to the works of Virgil that have been, in his view, neglected, left gathering dust on the shelves, and are thus silent or hoarse, partially read, partially understood, barely sounding forth. And Dante replies, "Have mercy on me, whatever you may be, whether shade or true man." And Virgil famously replies, "I am not a man. I was a man. Non homo, homo già fui." At a recent conference I went to, it was argued quite forcefully that the line, "I am not a man, I was a man," implies Virgil's gender dysphoria. That Virgil is having, at this point, a crisis of gender identity. That tells you something about the state of Italian studies. The more obvious interpretation, however, is that Virgil is stating a fact. When he was alive, he was a man. But having died, he is not a man, because a man is a composite of soul and body, and death is nothing other than the separation of a man's soul from his body. Virgil is now, therefore, only the soul of a man. And by the way, that is also, of course, the reason why, with one notable exception, Mary, there are no men or women in heaven or hell. There are only the souls of men and women, at least until the resurrection of the body. So Virgil replies, "I am not a man, I was a man." It is the soul of Virgil, not the man Virgil, who speaks then to Dante. And it is the soul of an author, which, according to a medieval commonplace, may, at least partially, be encountered through his or her writings, through picking up that book, gathering dust and waiting to be discovered on the shelves. And I find it very moving and inspiring how Dante describes the long study and the great love that has made me search through your Virgil's work, and that led him to a deep intimacy, a profound friendship with the soul, with the essence of Virgil, such that Dante can refer to him not only as my master, mio maestro, and my author, mio autore, but a few lines later as my sweet father, dolce padre. this opportunity of encounter across centuries and thus beyond the fallacy of presentism and the tyranny of passing ideologies, across continents and cultures and across languages, as for Dante, who humbly recounts his own struggles with mastering Latin. This is surely one of the great gifts of literature. It is how we come to know the voices of the past. It is how, as G.K. Chesterton put it, we enter into contact with the democracy of the dead. It is how we can come to develop true relationships with authors of the past. As Dante, across a time span, a long silence of some 1300 years, did with Virgil. And as we are invited to do, across half that time span, a mere 700 years, with Dante. I first encountered Dante at university as a non-Catholic, atheist, agnostic student, or should I say, in the beginning of the journey of our adult life, the soul of Dante appeared to me in a dark wood. In choosing to talk this evening about Dante's passionate intellect, I'm doing so because this is what first attracted me to Dante. In talking about the Divine Comedy's journey of desire, again, this is because, as a student seeking meaning and purpose in my own life, in a highly secular university context, which in many respects had lost sight of the core human desires for truth, for goodness and beauty, Dante became somewhat of a prophetic guide. Dante opened up for me an extraordinary world of meaning, of theology, philosophy, literary and artistic culture, of encounters with manifold other authors whom he introduced me to, classical and Christian, and much else besides. Dante became for me an ongoing master, a friend, a guide, and so I'm going to commend him to you this evening. Being moved by Dante. In being moved by Dante, I was, of course, neither the first nor the last, but simply one in an innumerable procession of people thus moved. The theologian Peter Hawkins writes, "Readers of Dante have nothing to lose in coming to the Divine Comedy, except perhaps life as they've known it thus far." And the term passionate intellect was coined to describe, in fact, Dorothy Sayers and her own profound encounter with Dante, which came quite late, but which led her to devote her own passionate intellect to Dante, who became her master, prompting her, after a life of journalism and crime writing, crime fiction, I should say, to write a translation of the Divine Comedy in Terza Rima in the Penguin Classic series, which would become immensely popular with its English-speaking audience. And this is what Sayers wrote about her encounter with Dante. "I saw the whole layout of Dante's hell as something actual and contemporary, something that one can see by looking into oneself or into the pages of tomorrow's newspaper. I saw it, that is, as a judgment of fact, unaffected by its period, unaffected by its literary or dogmatic origins. And I recognized at the same moment that the judgment was true." Now, that's a wonderful response to Dante, I think. Some readers are put off the complexity of Dante's poem or by the numerous otherwise unknown details of individuals and historical events, or even by its geocentric, outdated cosmology. But Dorothy Sayers could immediately see beyond all of this. She understood that Dante uses what we see, how the world appears to us, and let's face it, the sun still does appear to us to rise in the east and set in the west. That hasn't changed. Dante uses what we see to explore, describe, and represent our inner world, the unseen moral, emotional, psychological, and spiritual realities that perhaps our triumphant materialism sometimes may obscure from view. As Dante himself writes in The First Heaven of the Moon, not because he believes that there are literally saints hovering around the moon, but in order to signify a particular spiritual reality. They, a group of saints, did here in the sphere of the moon show themselves, but not because this sphere had been allotted them as theirs. They signify celestial power least raised. To speak in this way fits the human mind. For you only grasp through things you've sensed what mind will then present as fit for thought. For this same reason, Scripture condescends to your capacities and says that God has hands and feet, though meaning otherwise. So Holy Church will also represent Michael and Gabriel with human face, the other two who helped heal Tobit's sight. Thus does even Dante's geocentric cosmology describe a spiritual and moral reality. He imagines that after the great cosmic battle in heaven, Lucifer, the light bearer, the brightest of the angels, fell from heaven, plummeting towards the earth. But because the earth is good, the earth recoils in horror from Satan, creating the spiraling funnel of hell with Satan stuck ludicrously frozen in ice at its center. Because God out of every evil brings about some good, this displaced earth created in the southern hemisphere the mountain of purgatory, the way back to God already prepared for man who would, tempted by Satan, be drawn into sin. And finally, then Dante depicts the extraordinary and brilliant diversity of the saints' holiness and gifts, the beauty of the saints' lives as a witness to the Christian faith through the 10 heavens, even though, as he emphasizes, all the saints, in fact, reside in the Empyrean beyond space and time. To these three great realms of the Christian afterlife, the funnel of hell, the mountain of purgatory, the spheres of paradise, Dante devotes three great songs, three canticles. The poem's first general purpose being to sing the glory of God. The Inferno about hell comprises 34 small songs, cantos, the Purgatorio, 33 cantos, and the Paradiso, 33 cantos, meaning that the Divine Comedy as a whole comprises 100 cantos, a perfect number. The whole poem, moreover, is stamped formally with the great mystery of the Christian faith, and here we are in Trinity College, that God is one in three persons, from the macro level, one poem in three parts, to the micro level, the poem's basic unit, a three-line terzina, one in three. So how does this great Christian epic, this great Christian epic to rival the great epics of classical antiquity begin? In the middle of the journey of our life, I came to myself in a dark wood, for the straight way was lost. Ah, how hard a thing it is to say what that wood was, so savage and harsh and strong that the very thought of it renews my fear. Where the wrath of Achilles provides the narrative impetus for Homer's Iliad, and Virgil sings Arma virumque cano of Aeneas' exile and subsequent founding of Rome, it is Dante's own sin and ignorance that begin and orient his Christian journey and his Christian epic narrative. Why? Because our faith tells us that we are made in the image of God with an intellect, a capacity to know, and a will, a capacity to love. But it also tells us, although that's quite apparent to any of us with even the smallest bit of reflection, that we are born in ignorance. It is a dark wood in which we find ourselves. And we are born in sin, a wood so savage and harsh and strong that the very thought of it renews our fear. We neither know the right way, the straight way was lost, nor are we able to escape from sin and ignorance on our own. Dante's first words, as we've seen, are miserere di me, have mercy on me. We are made in the image of God. We have an intellect and a will. We are knowing and desiring creatures. And we, whether here in the Republic of Ireland or in Scotland, the UK, where I've come from, are free to know and desire pretty much as we like. Freedoms, of course, we should never take for granted. Nonetheless, we will be called to account, even if only by our future selves, for how we use this precious freedom. No one, I mean, you're all beautiful, most of you are very young and beautiful, but I promise you, no one can honestly say, je ne regrette rien. Right. I tell you, maybe you can at this stage, but in a university context offering so much and such different areas of knowledge, we sometimes don't know what to know, or even what is most important to know. And in a marketplace that seeks to draw us to so many delectable things, our desires are confused. Our soul is like a deer, secret cervus, trapped in a dense thicket, unable to get out. The Divine Comedy, I suggest then, the soul of Dante, comes to us then with a great opportunity, the telling of a great journey of desire from sin and ignorance to holiness and virtue. In an epistle to his patron, Dante wrote indeed that the very purpose of his great poem is to lead people in this life from the state of misery, the misery of sin and ignorance, and direct them to the beatitude of heaven. Yes, the poem tells us in allegorical and symbolic form Dante's own confessional journey of desire from sinner to saint. But Dante is also an everyman. His journey is our journey. He writes in the middle of the journey of our life, not just in the middle of the journey of my life. And on this journey, we, like him, are never alone. Like him, we also have the inestimable resources of Catholic theology, philosophy, and culture, of history, on which to draw. And these resources are, in the poem, in a typological sense, mapped principally by the two main guides of Dante's journey, Virgil and Beatrice. So we have three canticles in one great poem, three realms, hell, purgatory, and paradise in one afterlife. There are then these three main characters, these three principal protagonists in the one Christian epic journey, Dante himself, Virgil, and Beatrice. And following again the theological principle of one in threeness, each character has three main offices corresponding to the three great divisions of human activity as categorized by Aquinas following Aristotle. Speculative knowledge, the ratio speculabilium, which concerns the truth. Morality, the ratio agibilium, which concerns the good. And art, the ratio factibilium, which concerns making and the beautiful. Dante is the type for the everyman Christian. He is a sinner whose heart or will seeks virtue, the good. He is, like you, a student whose passionate intellect desires the truth, desires knowledge. And he is a maker, a poet, a creator of beautiful fictions. Virgil is a type for the natural order. He is an instructor in natural virtue. He teaches Dante, essentially, Aristotelian ethics. He refers to Aristotelian ethics. He is a teacher of philosophical truth, and he is a guide in poetry, a master poet. Beatrice, finally, is a type for the Christian supernatural order. In the practical field of morals, she is grace and the light of glory. In the speculative field of knowledge, she is faith and the light of glory. And in the realm of making, she is the very beauty of Christian revelation that draws us to God. In the figure of Beatrice, that is, Dante represents the truth, goodness, and beauty of the Christian faith, of the Christian supernatural order that draws us to God. On a moral reading of the poem's opening, then, Dante, the historical Dante, in the year 1300, at the height of his worldly success as one of the most powerful men in Florence and a celebrated poet, scholar, and statesman, recognizes himself, nonetheless, as lost in that dark wood of sin and ignorance, calling out the great penitential Psalm 50, Miserere me, have mercy on me. Beatrice, symbolizing grace, sends reason, which is weak, which is barely heard, which is hoarse in the mind of the sinner, to show Dante, every man, the baseness of human vices in hell, to show him that is the state of misery of a contemporary godless world looked at through a spiritual gaze. Dante's hell, after all, is simply a world where hope in God is left behind, as its famous inscription informs us, leave all hope, you who enter here. Lasciate ogni speranza voi che entrate. Virgil, reason, accompanies Dante, the everyman, up the mountain of purgatory, a vision of the Christian pathway of ever greater friendship with God and neighbour in love through virtue and through combating vice. And finally, Virgil, even reason, has to be held behind as Virgil leaves Dante with Beatrice, the supernatural order herself, to see the extraordinary beauty and holiness of life that such a journey of desire makes possible and is its eternal reward. Intellect, reason, will, free will, love. As Dante follows Virgil on this journey, so we, every man, are invited then to follow Dante on his imaginative journey of desire through the realms of the Christian afterlife. And as we do so, surprise builds on surprise. On entering Hell's Gate, we see first a group of souls running behind a standard, stung incessantly by a swarm of hornets and wasps, their faces streaming with blood. These are, in Dorothy Sayers' translation, the scum who never really lived, the souls who, in the great cosmic battle between good and evil in each individual person's life, sat on the fence. They are the weak-willed, the agnostics, who failed to do evil or good. They failed, that is, to make use of the great gift given to us as human beings, free will, and are thus despised by God and Satan alike, vomited up by both by Satan. So I think that prospect of being stung in eternity by swarms of wasps is a really helpful image to get you out of bed in the morning. You know, you're sort of lying in bed, saying, oh God, just have another seat. Just remember that. And of course, that's the point, right? This is kind of an ethical poem, supposed to get you out of bed in the morning. Then, after, tells about free will. Then we pass into the first circle of hell, which, surprise again, is instead rather pleasant. A place not of suffering and pain, but rather a kind of beautiful college. I mean, a bit like walking around Trinity College, Dublin. And we encounter there the great heroes and heroines of classical antiquity, and within a castle encircled by seven walls, a philosophical family, with Plato and Socrates in conversation with Aristotle, the master of those who know. How delightful, you might think. Here we see the wonderful fruits of the will put to use, active use, in the flourishing of our natural powers, including preeminently our God-given light of reason, a gift which, however limited, distinguishes us as rational from the other animals. And then we descend past the ghastly figure of Minos to the first sinners of commission, the lovers, tossed eternally in a howling wind. From those lovers whose lust had led them even to incest, to change the laws of a country in favour of incest indeed, to the refined and graceful Francesca and Paolo, Dante's contemporaries, who would come to embody in the 19th, well, you might say from the 19th to the present, really, 19th century to the present, the very ideal of romantic love. Many of you will have seen, for example, Rodin's famous sculpture, The Kiss, which was originally entitled Francesca and Paolo. Francesca and Paolo are kind of there in about 99% of modern rom-coms, you know. Romantic love. Free will, reason, love. These are the three key human and anthropological principles which emerge from our encounter with the first three groups of Dante's Hell. Our freedom to choose, our capacity to know, and our capacity to be moved by love. In the very centre of the Purgatorio and of the poem as a whole, Dante presents the drama of the human moral life as a sometimes delicate balancing of these three great principles. We are all desiring creatures. We are all lovers. And we are also free to choose and to choose in accordance with knowledge and our reason. Dante describes the human soul as loved into existence by God, forth of his God's hands, whose brooding tenderness loves her, or ere she comes to be, is brought laughing and weeping like a babe that plays, the simple infant soul. That, all untaught, but moved by a glad maker, turns with pleasure to this or that by which her fancies caught. It is, I think, a beautiful account of how, created by God in love and loved by God, we are born set in motion by him as loving and desiring creatures who respond first instinctively to the world around us. Rather than, like Descartes might suggest, starting from our own consciousness, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, and then moving on to analyse the world, the supposed subjective turn in modern philosophy, in reality, in actual fact, from our birth, it is the world that impresses itself on us. Whether it be the colours of our environment impressing themselves now on our eyes, the sound of my voice ineluctably impressing itself on your ears, the temperature of this building impressing itself on our skin, the world draws and attracts us, impacts us in different ways. So that baby is drawn instinctively to the milk in his mother's breast, and then to other things that delight him, food, chocolate, toys, and all this because the baby is made for love and is first unknowingly seeking his or her maker. Equally, though, our desires can and do go astray, and we need, in Dante's words, a law, a rule, a guide to curb and direct our desires. For Dante, this is where our free will and reason come in. The world is drawing us with multiple desires, but we have free will, the capacity to assent or not to assent to a given desire. And we have reason, a counselor power innate, set there to guard the threshold of assent. Let's speak very simply, you know, I may see a slice of chocolate cake and knowing it to be intensely pleasurable, the chocolate cake may attract me towards it. However, I do not have to assent to that desire, inclining towards it in love. We are not our desires. In the Purgatorio, in a beautiful allegory of the famous siren of classical myth who leads men in the voyage of this life to moral shipwreck, Dante alludes to all the limited goods that humans are drawn to by various desires. The vanity of fame or human glory, the instability of wealth, the limits of power, the childish vanity of sensual pleasures. Although Dante's is, in Dorothy Sayers' words, a way of affirmation, and he thinks we should delight in the good of the world, like Augustine, Dante also shows us how the goods of the world can trap us if our loves are not ordered to God. When, on the terrace of envy, Dante is drawn to a soul because of his love of Italy, he is reminded, "Oh, my dear brother, everyone is a citizen of the true city, but you meant to say that you lived in Italy as a pilgrim." When Dante sees souls weighed down by the huge boulders of their pride, whether in artistic glory, wealth and power, or noble ancestry, he is reminded, "Do you not realize that we are worms born to form angelic butterflies?" This world, in other words, is a chrysalis, a place of growth, of delight, and of patient suffering, but a temporary stage in our destiny as human beings, and never its end. Dante's Purgatorio especially seeks to chart the human process of spiritual transformation, a training in the virtues and battle against the vices, a transformation of human desire. "I will sing," he says, "of that second realm, purgatory, where the human spirit purges itself and becomes worthy to ascend to heaven." Okay, so the passionate intellects in hell and heaven. As an undergraduate at university, I was naturally drawn to Dante's intellectuals, the passionate intellects in his poem. I'd first encountered Aristotle's Ethics. One of those incredible experiences, you know, that sure you have whatever subject you do, you sort of encounter, but wow, you know, it kind of changes your life. And I developed a real love for classical philosophy, even being adopted as an honorary philosopher, something I was very proud of at the time. So Dante's celebration of Aristotle, Plato, and Socrates certainly appealed to me. But I was particularly struck by another group of passionate intellectuals, the first group of heretics one encounters on entering into Dante's infernal city of Dis, where each heretical sect has its own burning graveyard. Remarkably, Dante focuses on a sect which isn't even a distinctively Christian heresy at all. The followers of Epicurus, who hold that when the body dies, so too the soul. To Epicurus is attributed the beguiling aphorism, "We have no fear of death, for when we are, death is not, and when death is, we are not." I was struck, that is, that Dante places within his vision of the Christian afterlife a group of people who deny that there is an afterlife at all. In other words, there's room in his poem even for an atheist. Indeed, the central dialogue in this episode, which is an incredible piece of literature, is between Dante and the father and father-in-law of his first friend Guido Cavalcanti, a renowned philosopher, poet, and statesman, whom the later poet Boccaccio would describe as simply an atheist. I was drawn to these medieval atheists because they were not, like so many contemporary atheists, it seemed to me, epicures in the modern sense. They did not live a life, a wasted life of sensual or even of more refined pleasures. Instead, Dante seemed to be referring to a truly honourable and philosophical life, which spurns the life of the senses while equally holding in contempt, as little more than human fables, the revealed religions of the three Abrahamic faiths. Another passionate intellect who intrigued me in Dante's poem was Dante's Ulysses, who gives an account of what it is to be a human being, of the dignity of a human being, which has run down the ages. A humanism even inspiring the Jewish chemist Primo Levi amidst the dehumanizing barbarity of Auschwitz, with a reason to go on. "Consider," Ulysses addresses his followers, "consider your origins, You were not made to live like beasts, but to follow virtue and knowledge. So this philosophical and human message had a profound impact on me. I still have on my desk a clay paperweight of Ulysses, which I bought while backpacking as a student in Sicily. Dante has such a profound respect for this human searching for truth and goodness, and for those, whether of faith or not, who try to seek to lead a truly human and humanizing life. Nonetheless, I couldn't help but see that the pagan philosophers, the Epicureans and Ulysses, all do end up, whatever their qualities, in Dante's hell. Moreover, I was also being introduced by Dante and by my teachers to other great Christian writers, and for me the most influential, to St. Thomas Aquinas. In The Heaven of the Sun, the heaven of the lovers of wisdom, Dante gives preeminence, indeed, to St. Thomas Aquinas. So in his poem, only Dante, Virgil and Beatrice are afforded more lines than him. Characteristically, nonetheless, Dante's St. Thomas introduces himself humbly with the words, "I was among the lambs of the holy flock that Dominic leads by a path where one fattens well if one does not wander." And St. Thomas introduces Dante to the first garland of the wise, 12 passionate intellects who followed their desire for truth, including his teacher, St. Albert the Great, Peter Lombard, Boethius, St. Bede, and Cedar of Brabant. Seeing this constellation of the wise, Dante berates the narrowness of so much study down below. It's very painful for me to read each time. "O imbecile ambition of mortality, what ill-directed reasoning syllogistical weight down thy wings to mundane triviality, and the sometimes overworldly ambitions and desires that drive it, chasing juridical or aphoristical successes, one bent on business, one on spoliation, another fagging at his carnal pleasure. While Dante, at blessed leisure from all these cares, at Beatrice's side, enjoyed heaven's welcome in right glorious measure. These souls that multiply out in further garlands were lovers of God." And appropriately, Dante celebrates in his Heaven of Wisdom, in particular, the lives of St. Francis and St. Dominic, whose orders would lead to the foundation and establishment of the great universities across Europe, the great institutional settings for the communal quest for truth. We shouldn't forget that. Dante presents St. Dominic and St. Francis, indeed, as the true ideal romantic lovers and chivalric knights, the two champions sent to the aid of Christ's bride, the Church, by whose deeds and words the straying people were brought to themselves. St. Francis, seraphic in love, St. Dominic, an amorous lover of the Christian faith, the holy athlete, benign towards his own, but harsh towards his enemies. The saints in heaven, that is, are passionate lovers, and Dante gives a picture, a vision of the Christian faith as a great love story, where no limit is placed on the object of one's desire, because that object is no worldly thing, but God. Dante's journey started in a dark wood, his mind in ignorance, his will in sin. As G.K. Chesterton intuited, the lives of St. Dominic and St. Francis are witnesses to the Christian perfections of that human intellect and human will. St. Dominic, espoused to the Christian faith, placed a special emphasis on truth, the perfection and goal of the intellect, in seeking to grow in knowledge of God. St. Francis espoused to Christian poverty and freed thereby from material attachments, shows the Christian perfection of the will in its love of God and neighbour. Many, though, are the flowers of Dante's paradise. That's why it's worth exploring. A lot of people just read Dante's Inferno, but really, the Purgatory and the Paradiso are much better. In my own life, I became particularly attracted to the scent, as it were, of the passionate intellects and ultimately of the wise in the heaven of the sun. And it's been my great privilege and fortune to be able to continue as a very unworthy, a very ignorant and very sinful student of the likes of St. Thomas Aquinas and Dante. But as the different spheres of Dante's paradise further highlight, there are so many other Christian pathways and vocations. So, to conclude, the poet of hope. Whatever their vocations in this life, all Christians are joined in their faith, hope, and charity. And in the sphere of the fixed stars, Dante encounters the souls of St. Peter, St. James, and St. John, and he's examined in a kind of pastiche of a university exam of the time on the virtues of faith, hope, and charity. On the occasion of the 700th anniversary of Dante's death in 2021, Pope Francis's apostolic letter, Candor Lucis Aeternae, proclaimed Dante in particular as a prophet of hope. I'm just quoting from that letter now. Dante reads the depths of the human heart. Starting from his own personal situation, Dante becomes the interpreter of the universal human desire to follow the journey of life to its ultimate destination, when the fullness of truth and the answers to life's meaning will be revealed, and in the words of St. Augustine, our hearts find their rest and peace in God. The journey that Dante presents is not illusory or utopian. It is realistic and within the reach of everyone. For God's mercy always offers the possibility of change, conversion, new self-awareness and discovery of the path to true happiness. At this particular moment in history, so he's talking about 2021, 4 years ago, overclouded by situations of profound inhumanity and a lack of confidence and prospects for the future, the figure of Dante, prophet of hope and witness to the human desire for happiness, can still provide us with words and examples that encourage us on our journey. Dante can help us to advance with serenity and courage on the pilgrimage of life and faith that each of us is called to make, until our hearts find true peace and true joy, until we arrive at the ultimate goal of all humanity. Dante, who in his own life experienced failure, exile, and impoverishment, many a reason to despair, is thus a particular guide for us, peregrinantes in spem, as pilgrims of hope today. As we come towards the end of this Jubilee Year of Hope in 2025, let me conclude this talk then by reading a couple of excerpts from the beginning of Canto 25 of Dante's Paradiso, the beautiful episode where Dante, still in exile from his beloved Florence and from the baptistry where he first entered the faith, a Christian, imagines meeting the soul of St. James in heaven. If it should ever chance that ere the sacred song to which both heaven and earth have set their hand, whence I am lean with labouring so long, should touch the cruel hearts by which I'm banned from the fair fold where as a lamb I lay, foe to the wolves which leagued against it stand. With altered voice, with altered fleece, today I shall return a poet at my font of baptism to take the crown of bay. For unto faith, whereby the Lord is wont to know them that are his, I entered there, and Peter, for that faith, now wreathed my front. To us there moved a light, leaving that sphere whence, answering my lady's prayer, had sped the very first of Christ's own vicars here. And Beatrice, with joyous rapture, said, behold, see how the baron, for whose sake Santiago's shrine on earth is visited. Just as a pupil answering a master, in eagerness to show his expertise, the readier he is, replies the faster, hope, I began, is certainty of bliss to come, which God, by grace, concedes to us and for our previous merit promises. From many stars this light to me proceeds. But he who first instilled it in my heart, in praising God, all songs of praise exceeds. Sper in tinte, they hope in thee, so sings he in one part of his great psalmody, who thy name know. Who of my faith can know not who thou art? Next, in thine own epistle, didst thou, Saint James, so instill me with his dew, that evermore brimmed with your rain, on others I overflow. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.